It is 8:30, and we have with us once again Maria Tomchik, co-editor at Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Again, no job this week. He's still on the road.
That's right. He'll be back late tonight.
Be back late tonight. All right. Assuming everything goes well. His
yes.
car doesn't break down again. But that's another story we're not going to go into. So last week you brought us up to speed on what was going on with the monorail, and I understand there's some updates on that.
Somewhat up to speed. There's a lot going on with the monorail, and I wanted to talk about it again this morning. The city council approved this week a portion of the route, the portion that runs through the Seattle Center, by a 5-4 vote. The folks who voted for running the monorail through the Seattle Center were Nick Licata, Richard McIver, Jim Compton, Jan Drago, and Gene Godden. And the folks who voted against had some interesting criticisms, and I just wanted to address some of them. Now, first of all, I want to say that I work in the South Queen Anne area, and I use the Seattle Center quite a bit as a park. And I have to say personally that I think that when folks say that the Seattle Center represents the largest piece of open space in the downtown Seattle area, I have to laugh. For one thing, it's not in the downtown Seattle area. For another, you can't by any stretch of the imagination consider Seattle Center an open space. It is really mostly an amusement park, and the only time it ever even somewhat resembles open space is at about 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning when I'm commuting to work and I walk through the Seattle Center. And then there are maintenance vehicles running through the grounds all the time. So even then, it isn't really an open space or a green space. It's really obviously a facility that offers sort of convention space, and it functions as an amusement park. And you really see that first thing in the morning when there aren't any people there and there isn't a lot of noise. Now, the rest of the time, it's a very noisy, very high-use facility, and it's used similar to an amusement park. Most of the attractions are indoors, or they're the rides, or they're the fountain, and the fountain is noisy in and of itself, not because of the water, but because of the music that's played with the water and the little jets that are choreographed to music, etc., and the kids that run screaming down into the water and back out to their moms or to their teachers, and the teachers and moms and fathers who are screaming down at the kids, don't get your tennis shoes wet, etc. It's never a quiet place, and you can't, by any stretch of the imagination, consider it a green space. Now, there are some trees in the Seattle Center. That's true. There are also many, many more trees along Mercer Street, which would have to be taken out if the Mercer Street route had been approved. The few trees that will be taken out of the Seattle Center, some of them can be replanted. I also want to say that when I use the Seattle Center as a park, I have to say that the main attractions for me and most of the other people who sit there during their lunch hour and eat their lunch or spend some time there on their break at work, the main attractions are sunshine when the sun is out, and clean places to sit, and the fact that you can get food there fairly cheaply. So none of these things are things that you would consider part of an open space or a green belt or whatever. So when Peter Steinbrück said that when he compared running the monorail through the Seattle Center and said it was similar to efforts to tear down the Pike Place Market or build a freeway through the Arboretum, I just had to laugh. I mean, I think this person has never really used the Seattle Center like people in the neighborhood have, or people who come and use it regularly for festivals or attend the theaters there, or use any of the indoor attraction, any of the indoor facilities like the Center House on a regular basis, or folks who come and use it as a convention facility, as it's used a lot during the week, during business hours. Now, another thing that was said, Conlon said running the monorail down Mercer Street would have no impact, and he was concerned about losing trees in the Seattle Center. Well, as I said, many more trees are along Mercer Street would have to be taken down if you ran the monorail along Mercer Street, which some folks might argue is actually more of a green space than the Seattle Center because of all of the trees. The fact that he thinks it would have no impact when Mercer Street is the major traffic corridor from South Queen Anne out towards the freeway and other parts of Seattle, not downtown, but other parts of Seattle. Mercer Street is the main corridor. Now, folks may have heard about the Mercer Street mess. That's often thought to be where Mercer Street crosses Aurora, or where Mercer Street reaches I-5. Well, I have to tell you, Mercer Street can be a real mess near the Seattle Center as well whenever there's any kind of construction or any lanes blocked off. So blocking that off in order to build the monorail and devoting perhaps a whole lane, or devoting large portions of the street only to monorail construction, would be a terrible mess and have a terrible impact on the businesses in South Queen Anne, in the South Queen Anne area. It also, he said it would have no impact on theater goers. I don't believe that would be the case either. I think it would have a significant impact on theater goers too. And if you live or work in that part of Seattle, you realize that a lot of the businesses in that area really depend on the theater goers to keep them alive. It's not the occasional events at Key Arena that keep these restaurants and businesses going. It's really the continual presence of theater goers who keep those businesses alive. Now, and then David Della urged the city council to review the Thomas Street option. That would be the monorail coming into the Seattle Center and then going back out along Thomas Street. Now, Thomas Street, really, if you walk through the Seattle Center and you look at what part of Queen Anne would be served by running the monorail along Thomas Street, you would realize that it's really not connecting with the neighborhood the same way that it does if it goes through the Seattle Center via the Northwest route that the city council approved. So personally, now I don't know how Job feels about this. He might feel completely differently. He might agree with Peter Steinbrück. But I definitely feel that there is very little harm to placing a ride through the Seattle Center that actually goes somewhere, as opposed to some of the rides where you just go around and around and around in a circle. So,
I actually think it should go actually through the fountain itself. No one is proposing
In that. Fact, for folks who don't know where the Northwest route goes, it actually goes north. It goes up along. It goes through the Experience Music Museum. And then it goes around the east side of the center house, so it would cut through the Fun Forest, the amusement park rides there, so some of those would have to be moved or taken out. It goes along the west side of Memorial Stadium and then along the east side of the fountain. And then once it gets north of the fountain, it goes along, there's a sort of a large concrete pathway or large concrete road there. It would go along that. It would take a turn towards the west and go along that route, and it would pass Bagley Wright Theater on the south and go out the northwest end of the park, and there would be a station located right there at the northwest end of the park. One of the good things about putting a station there is that it would take down the northwest rooms and rebuild those so that it would open up the whole northwest section of the Seattle Center to the neighborhood. That's been something that the neighborhood folks have, and I know I feel this way as well, that the park is often closed off from the neighborhood because of the northwest rooms being there with their backs to the neighborhood. Taking those out and rebuilding them in a way that opens up the park to the neighborhood would be just, I think, a major improvement.
All right. Well,
now, I also want to remind folks that there are some more serious issues regarding the monorail that are not being discussed while everybody spends a lot of ink and a lot of time talking about, isn't it terrible that they're running the monorail through the Seattle Center? Some of those more serious issues include discussions of the route in West Seattle along California Avenue Southwest. Monorail project folks want to run the trains about 5 feet from the buildings along California Avenue Southwest. Now, the city council this week approved a change in the downtown route along 2nd Avenue that would set the trains back from the buildings at least 14 feet. Now, the monorail project folks wanted to run them within 5 feet of the buildings there, and the city council opted for the more expensive option there. So there's going to be a question now: are they going to do the same for West Seattle, or are they going to let it stand that the train should run 5 feet from the buildings in West Seattle? That's going to be a major battle coming up. And there are also questions about the route through West Seattle. Evidently, it takes turns that it takes some 90-degree turns in the West Seattle route and takes it along certain streets that would be that would make the construction much more expensive than if they ran it down Fauntleroy Avenue. They should seriously look at running it down Fauntleroy Avenue, where I don't think it would have a major impact on the businesses there. So that's a serious question about the route. There are some other issues, too. The council has until June 14th to approve the route, because on June 15th, the very next day, the two companies that are competing to build the monorail will be submitting their bids for the construction and the operation of the Green Line. That raises the question of, aren't we approving the route a little quickly? Some of these big issues that are more important than the Seattle Center issue might not get enough time to really be looked at well. And if it's approved on June 14th, then isn't that not giving the two construction companies enough time to really put together a bid that's going to be reasonable and realistic? I think it adds to the potential for cost overruns.
And you had brought that up last week, that the oversight panel was saying that things were moving along too quickly.
Yes, and I think that the oversight panel raised some good and serious questions, too, about the fact that the city council and the city is being asked to approve things on the monorail without really being able to see a good design for it. Now, there's also the question of the privatized nature of the operation of the monorail. Once it's built, the company that will have built the monorail will have a contract with the city to operate the monorail for 5 years. It'll be a private company that operates it. It won't be the city. Now, I've written before, we haven't talked on this program, but I've written before about Britain's failed experiment in privatizing the British railway system and how they've had to go back and renationalize large portions of British Rail and the London Underground. They've had to look at severe sanctions against some of the companies that have let maintenance slip on the London Underground and the British rail lines, how there have been major train accidents that Britain hadn't seen up to that time, and how the unions have complained of efforts to bust and break the unions in Britain. It's just been a major mess, and I think that should also be revisited, whether or not, and it is kind of late in the game now, but the city can revisit the issue of whether or not they should allow a private company operate the Green Line and how much oversight we'll have over that private company.
We can see similar problems with letting private companies be in charge of maintenance with the two stadiums, which are both already, you know, falling apart,
right,
and developing major cracks and water leaks and stuff. So
right. And in addition, another issue that's coming up, and I think this addresses the expensive monorail ads that we've seen and that have been criticized by some folks, that the Seattle Monorail Project is spending millions of dollars running this ad campaign. You know, maybe you've seen them on TV or seen them in print or heard them on radio. You know, the monorail is coming. That's what they basically say. And those ads you could see as being targeted towards the monorail recall folks. There's a group of people who are putting together a ballot initiative and trying to get signatures to put this initiative on the November ballot to recall the monorail. So basically to end the construction and the planning process for the Green Line and simply preserve the monorail that exists now from downtown to the Seattle Center. So those folks will be out this summer gathering signatures and hoping to get enough to place it on the ballot for November. So that's another threat to the monorail system that should be discussed more and is not being discussed at all.
All right, anything else on that?
Nope, let's move on.
All right, well, I guess that takes us to This Week in Iraq.
We talked in prior weeks about the problems with U.S. troops surrounding the cities of Fallujah and Najaf in Iraq, and I just want to address those very quickly. This week, we haven't heard much about what's been going on there because all of the news has been dominated by the Iraq prisoner photos, which I'll talk about in a minute. The things that have been going on around Najaf and Karbala and Kufa in southern Iraq, where the Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr is holed up with his militia members, U.S. troops have been surrounding those three cities. They do not have control of those three cities yet, but this week the U.S. troops and some Polish troops and other coalition troops have been slowly trying to take back portions of Kufa and Karbala and have also made some moves into Najaf. Now, they had stopped on Friday because it was the holy day, and today and tomorrow and next week, we will start to see much more fighting between al-Sadr's militia members and U.S. troops. So folks should keep an eye out for that if it's possible, if anything is being reported on it in the news. If not, I'll hunt it down and I'll try to present some information on it next week.
Now, my understanding is it's not just al-Sadr's militia members that are fighting in those areas. Is that right?
There are some other folks who have joined them who are not considered members of al-Sadr's militia. And there are some questions about whether there aren't also some Sunni Arabs who have joined up, seeing it as the same struggle. The Sunni Arabs in Fallujah being surrounded by U.S. Marines and al-Sadr and his militia being surrounded by U.S. and coalition troops in the south of the country. Now, in Fallujah, U.S. Marines pulled back this week to checkpoints outside of the city, and they allowed General Jassim Mohammed Saleh to take over in Fallujah. Now, Saleh is a former commander of Saddam's Republican Guard. It took a couple days for that news to leak out, but it has. Lawmakers in Congress here in Washington, D.C., and Shiites in Iraq, particularly members of the Iraqi Governing Council, immediately protested the resurrection of General Saleh. And they said he's been accused of participating in oppression of Iraq's Kurdish minority population and also in the suppression of the Shiite uprising in 1991 after the first Gulf War. So the Pentagon immediately said, well, gosh, you know, Saleh isn't really in charge. We've found this other Iraqi general who's going to be his boss. And that other guy, his name is General Mohammed Latif. Now, he comes from before the Saddam era. So he was basically in charge of intelligence and suppression of the Iraqi Kurdish minority and the Shiite population before Saddam was in power. So he's okay. So now, General Saleh is clearly meant to appease the local Sunni population of Fallujah. That's why he was appointed. While General Latif is supposed to be the happy face to cover for the re-Ba'athification of Fallujah, and as some folks suspect, the re-Ba'athification of the whole country. Now, Saleh's first act was to deny U.S. Marines' top demand, which was to turn over foreign fighters in Fallujah. He basically said, there are no foreign fighters here. There are no insurgents here. It's all local people trying to defend their homes. Now, Mohammed Latif, once he was appointed, the Marines turned to him and they said, turn over the foreign fighters, okay? And Latif, who was supposed to reason with General Saleh, actually said on Thursday to U.S. Marines that they should withdraw completely from Fallujah and the surrounding area, and they should go home. His direct quote was, I want the American soldier to return to his camp. What I want more is that he return to the United States. They should leave very quickly, or there will be problems. He also reiterated Saleh's claim that there were no insurgents in Fallujah, and that there were only local people trying to defend their homes. So this is going to be a major conflict in the coming weeks, the U.S. Marines wanting something that these two new guys are not going to give up. I also want to talk very briefly, too, about one of the main reasons why General Saleh and General Latif want U.S. troops to leave Iraq is so that they can help reconstitute the old Iraqi army and eventually take over the country. And this is not a pipe dream on the part of these former members of Saddam's army and Republican Guard. It has actually now become a reality. Now, the current foreign minister, a guy named Ali Alawi, he was appointed by the Iraqi Governing Council. He is really furious that Generals Saleh and Latif are setting up a Sunni militia composed of former army troops in Fallujah. The militias are supposed to be disarmed or dissolved, or they're supposed to be folded into the new Iraqi army, and Ali Alawi can see that this is not going to happen. He's in control of the new Iraqi army, and there is no way that this new Sunni militia is going to be folded into the new Iraqi army. He's terrified, and so are other members of the governing council, that the old Iraqi army will just sweep the new one aside and will persuade George Bush that if he really wants security in Iraq, he should allow a military dictatorship to take power. So they're afraid of a Saddam light coming to power, and that he's going to be one of the ex-generals under Saddam Hussein. Now, folks who might remember the early days of the war, this is what the Bush administration was hoping for. They were hoping to go into the country and take out Saddam Hussein and one or two of his top guys, and they were hoping a lower-ranking general would step in and take charge and make it a new dictatorship. That was the Bush administration's goal. And it looks to the Iraqi Governing Council, and it should be looking to us, too, like that's where we're headed.
So, just took us a while, I guess, to get the red carpet over there.
To get there, yes. Uh-huh. Now, I want to spend the last few minutes of the program talking about some of the issues around the prisoner abuse photos. First of all, I just want to say the first question that anybody should have about these photos is this a unique thing or is it something that's systemic? Now, the things that argue for it being systemic, first of all, is that human rights groups have said that human rights groups here in the United States, I'm not talking about international human rights groups, but human rights and prisoner advocacy groups here in the United States say that this is common treatment in U.S. prisons, not in U.S.-run facilities in Iraq, but it is common treatment here in the United States in our newly privatized prison system. Now, there's an article in today's Seattle PI by Fox Butterfield. It's reprinted from the New York Times. I'm just going to read you a couple paragraphs out of this article. The experts also point out that the man who directed the reopening of the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq last year and trained the guards there resigned under pressure as director of the Utah Department of Corrections in 1997 after a mentally ill inmate died while shackled naked to a restraining chair for 16 hours. The Utah official, Lane McCotter, later became an executive of a private prison company, one of whose jails was under investigation by the Justice Department when he was sent to Iraq as part of a team of prison officials, judges, prosecutors, and police chiefs picked by Attorney General John Ashcroft to rebuild Iraq's criminal justice system. Okay, now there's one of your main arguments that it's a systemic problem. Now, it's also important to ask, what's a real timeline of who knew what and when about this abuse? Last year, the International Committee of the Red Cross complained to the Pentagon and to Paul Bremer that prisoners in Iraq were being severely abused in U.S.-run prisons there. Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch have been warning since 2001 that Afghan prisoners in U.S. custody have been mistreated in ways that are very similar to what we're seeing in these photos that have been released. Last year, in September of 2003, by the way, there's one interesting photo that we haven't seen much of in the papers. It's an Associated Press picture of Donald Rumsfeld touring the Abu Ghraib prison on September 6, 2003, where he's rubbing elbows with Brigadier General Janis Karpinski, who's been replaced because of the abuses at Abu Ghraib prison. Now, he was at the prison at the same time in late August and early September of 2003 that a team from the U.S. camp at Guantanamo visited Iraq to help U.S. troops at Abu Ghraib prison, had requested that that team come to help them in finding ways to extract more information from Iraqi prisoners. Now, one would have to ask the question, did the team from Guantanamo teach them these techniques? My guess is that yes, they did. And another question that has to be asked is, was Rumsfeld aware that that was going on? And was he giving the okay? And was he checking up on the progress of this training? Now, my other guess is that yes, he probably was. I don't think they would be using these techniques or stepping up interrogation that borders on and crosses the line into torture without approval from the highest level. Now, the Guantanamo team was headed by a man named Major General Jeffrey D. Miller. Jeffrey D. Miller has replaced Janis Karpinski as the head of Iraqi prisons, of U.S.-run prisons in Iraq. So there is a cover-up going on, and it is continuing. The man who helped teams come in and train military police in these techniques is now the man that is in control of Abu Ghraib and the other prisons in Iraq. Now, the photos themselves were taken in October and November, shortly after the visit by the Guantanamo team. In November, Iraq's Human Rights Minister Abdel Basset Turki had a serious discussion with Paul Bremer about abuse of Iraqi prison prisoners in U.S. prisons in Iraq, and he asked to be allowed to visit the prisoners and to ensure their rights. Paul Bremer completely blew him off, so he knew about the problems as well. It was in January, it was mid-January, that a U.S. soldier approached high command with the photos and said, "Look at what's going on." High command, which didn't know that photos and videotape had been taken, immediately reacted with shock and horror, not at the acts themselves, I'm sure, but at the fact that there was photo evidence of them. The evidence was presented to them on January 13th. On January 14th, the very next day, General John Abizaid, commander of U.S. forces in Iraq, got on the phone with Donald Rumsfeld to discuss the problem. Now, Donald Rumsfeld, yes, that means he has known since mid-January about the problem. He probably knew long before them about the interrogation techniques being used, as we've said. But I'm sure his reaction also was, "My God, there are photos," because immediately after his little discussion with General John Abizaid, the videos and the photographs were confiscated from Abu Ghraib and sent to U.S. military headquarters in Baghdad and locked inside of a safe, and they've been kept secret, or as secret as they could be, since then. Of course, because the photos were passed out to among the soldiers at Abu Ghraib, widely passed out and circulated, some of them were leaked and got to CBS News, and that's how they've gotten to the public. Now, an internal criminal investigation was undertaken in January, and it was completed by March 15th. On March 20th, charges were filed against the six military police. So the Pentagon has known about this for a very long time. There has also been evidence from witnesses within the Bush administration saying that George Bush was briefed on this weeks ago. So his you could say that he's misleading the public. I think he's lying when he says that he hadn't known until this last week that there were these abuses going on. If he didn't know, it's because he wasn't listening when people were briefing him about it weeks and weeks ago. So it's been well known that high levels of the Bush administration have known about this problem, and that the problem is systemic, and that it has been, and that this abuse has been going on with the approval of at least Donald Rumsfeld. Now, on a personal level, I just want to say, looking at these photos reminds me of some other terrible evidence that I've seen when I was reviewing some of the photos of lynchings of black men in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. If you look at those photos, they look very similar to some of these photos, which argues for the incredible and violent racism behind these acts of taking these kind of trophies of the humiliation of Iraqi prisoners. Also, looking at these photos and reading some of the things that happened to Iraqi prisoners reminded me of reading the reports issued by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, who were investigating the crimes of the apartheid government in South Africa. So what's interesting is that while this is being covered by the U.S. media, the racism word is not being used at all, or the racism coupled with the oppression of an occupying authority of a repressive government, which is what the U.S. military has become in Iraq, and which you could argue what the U.S. government has become here as well.
Well, with that, we are out of time.
Have a nice morning. I warned you, Mike. I wanted to talk about this early in the program so that we could talk about nicer stuff towards the end.
Nope. They can handle it. Talking once again with Maria Tomchik. She is co-editor at Eat the State. And Maria, where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State can be found in bookstores, coffee shops, although we had trouble getting the money to print the last issue, so we desperately need donations from folks to keep printing the print version. You can find it for free online at www.eatthestate.org. And if you want to donate, please give us a call at 206-903-9461 or visit our website where you can find our address to send us a check.